This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
In early modern Europe, desire was policed. Same-sex desire, or at least acting on it, was especially forbidden. Many of the cases of sex between men we only know of because of their appearance in criminal cases. And many of the men involved suffered excruciating execution as punishment for their so-called crimes. But how does the evidence we have allow us to access the attitudes and behaviour of people experiencing same-sex desire and the response of their society to them? As we'll learn today, the evidence does not suggest that we can easily find a straightforward match for modern concepts of homosexuality in the past, which is one reason why, in the interests of accuracy and not judgment, historians often use the contemporary terms sodomy and sodomite as descriptors. On the basis of extensive Europe-wide research, today's guest demonstrates, in fact, that the practice of sexuality not only varies across time, but in early modern Europe, it varied across geography. My guest has published a new landmark study on male-male sexual relations between 1400 and 1750. He is Sir Noel Malcolm, Senior Research Fellow at All Souls College, Oxford. He was formerly a fellow at Gonville and Caius in Cambridge, foreign editor at The Spectator and a lecturer at Harvard. He's now a fellow of the British Academy and was knighted in 2014 for his services to scholarship, journalism and European history. His new book has been described by Sir Keith Thomas as a work of stunning erudition, far and away the best book to have been written on this challenging subject. It is called Forbidden Desire in Early Modern Europe. It's an extraordinary achievement, and I'm delighted to be joined by its author. Sir Noel Malcolm, thank you so much for joining me on Not Just the Tudors.
Very nice to be invited. Thank you.
We're talking about your extraordinary new book, which considers a phenomenal amount of research across Europe and beyond, I suppose one could say, realistically. And it's called Forbidden Desire in Early Modern Europe, and it is thinking about relationships between men from 1450 to 1700. I think perhaps where we ought to start is with the words we're going to use, the terminology, because, and we'll no doubt return to this, this is a period in which the word homosexual is not used in any way as it is today. What should we say?
Historians have considered this problem and have pretty unanimously settled on the word that was used at the time, which was sodomy, and therefore sodomite. And to those who haven't read in the modern historical literature on this, it may come as a bit of a shock. I think in modern English, it's got pretty negative connotations to use that vocabulary. And one doesn't want to sound like late Dr. Ian Paisley, who really did campaign on the slogan, "Save Ulster from Sodomy." But as you say, the word homosexuality or homosexual, this is a modern word. And indeed, this is part of the background to the big historical questions that I'm trying to deal with in the book. We know when and how these modern words were invented by theorists in the late 19th century. And it's been one of the arguments for a while was that homosexuality wasn't just that words were invented then, but that the whole phenomenon was invented. It wasn't possible to be a homosexual before that word existed. Now, that's a large question, which perhaps I'll just park for the moment because we're surely going to come back to that. But clearly, the modern word carries modern assumptions about what it is to be a homosexual, to what extent it's a statement about, so to speak, the whole person, not just about particular things they might do in bed. And it's obviously dangerous for a historian to carry a great bundle of modern assumptions unthinkingly back into previous periods. So at least the words sodomy and sodomite are just historical terms. And perhaps it's also useful that we don't use them so much nowadays, so we can now get a little bit of distance from them.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Now, you start this book by thinking about early modern Western assumptions that in North Africa and in the Ottoman Empire, there was a very real danger for young men of being taken captive for sexual exploitation and, associated with that, a conversion to Islam. What, as you ask, is a historian to make of such claims, this sort of othering of sodomy?
I think it is a reasonable question to ask, and one has to look at all the evidence carefully before trying to answer it. The standard approach of a lot of modern historians has been, I think, on a rather reflex basis, a reflex very much heightened by the influence of Edward Said's famous book about Orientalism, grand psychohistory of Western attitudes towards the East and especially the Islamic world, which taught everybody to see what the West said and wrote at that time as essentially a product of prejudice, the prejudice being a product of some sort of ultimately ideological, political interest. They wanted to conquer these territories, or at least to rule them, to have superiority over them, and therefore the ideology required them to depict everybody there as somehow inferior. I'm summarizing rather crudely, but that's the essential approach. And a generation of historians has been brought up on this. Said's famous book came out in 1978, so more than a generation. And it's been very easy for them to say, when you read accounts of 16th century travelers in the Ottoman Empire or 17th century Christian missionaries or diplomats, and they refer to the visibility of sodomy or sodomitical behavior in Muslim society, then it's obvious it's just prejudice. It's that Western Orientalist prejudice. But as I said, one needs to look at all the evidence. There is a lot of evidence on the Western side. They're not just repeating prejudicial slogans and things. In many cases, there are very specific accounts of experiences. Sometimes it's a young West European man who has been, so to speak, on the receiving end of sodomitical approaches. But then beyond that, and this is the strange thing that so few historians who write about this have bothered to look at, beyond that, there is a mass of Ottoman evidence from that society itself. This is, to my mind, a rather funny, no doubt completely unintended aspect of it, that the followers of Said, who tell us how wrong it is just to project Western attitudes and Western thinking onto the East, have just, in this case, completely ignored what the East itself was thinking and writing and saying, as if the only real debate had to be about Western attitudes. No, we have plenty of evidence from Ottoman writers, and not just writers of fiction, where you could argue about how much it conformed to reality, but historical writers, memoirists, people writing biographical articles for those great Ottoman biographical compilations. There is a wealth of evidence which confirms that sodomitical behavior was extremely common and was widely accepted. And that's a remarkable thing.
It certainly is. And you've given us a sense of what that Ottoman evidence is, the sort of types of evidence that you're using. One thing that emerges from your study of this evidence is that attraction to young men was not considered abnormal or deviant, but actually the norm. In what context could we find that attitude being played out?
In many different contexts. The idea that the desire on the part of an adult man or a teenage boy, or an attractive teenage boy, the idea that this desire was natural was absolutely genuine. Now, the desire is one thing, acting on it is another. So, of course, Islam was against committing the sexual act of sodomy. This was a grave sin. But it was perfectly possible, indeed it was absolutely standard, to say the desire is natural, it's only acting on it that is wrong. There's one, to westernize perhaps, extraordinary case where people asked the Grand Mufti of Istanbul in the 1530s for a fatwa, fatwa being essentially an authoritative legal pronouncement in response to a request for guidance on a dubious matter. And the request for guidance was this: in the mosque, when the men kneel down to pray, there's a very attractive 16-year-old boy in front of them. Is the imam correct in ordering the boy to move to somewhere else because he's distracting the men who are all having very impure thoughts while they're trying to pray? And the answer from the Grand Mufti was, yes, this is permitted for the imam to tell the boy to move if the boy is sexually desirable. So if it was a really ugly boy, then no, you can leave the ugly boy in front. But with a very sexually attractive boy, and use this a Turkish word for that, then this is absolutely correct. So there you have the highest religious legal authority in the Ottoman Empire, absolutely acknowledging the idea that this is standard. So it's your question was, in what context is this played out? And there's a huge range of social contexts. Of course, given the nature of Muslim society, women are much less visible outside the home. And so all kinds of contexts are ones essential of male sociability. Famously, the coffee houses, the hammams, the public baths. Women could also use those, but on different days or at different times. So when men went there, it was an all-male environment. The barber shops, other sorts of cafe, even taverns where alcohol was drunk, which was actually a very common thing. The owners were non-Muslims, but the clientele were Muslim. And you had waiters, you had apprentices, you had all kinds of boys, you had masseurs in the public baths. And a range of activity from flirtatious behavior to elevated men writing poems about the beauty of particularly beautiful young men in the vicinity to actual sex. A range of these forms of behavior took place. But I should just emphasize, because this is a fundamental point, we're talking about boys, teenage boys. It's men and boys. And this is one of the things that makes it so different from modern homosexuality. The boys were in their teens, and when they became fully masculine, and the marker for that was when they began to grow facial hair, which for nutritional reasons was later in those days, and this is pretty general across Europe, later than it is now. So around the age of 19, when a boy visibly becomes a man, then in this culture, he ceases to be desirable. However beautiful he was thought to be, however much men were writing poems about his beauty, when he becomes visibly a man, they lose interest, or at least they lose this sort of erotic interest. So this is one of the ways in which it's very different from modern homosexuality. It's not a sort of desire on the part of the masculine for the masculine. It's a desire on the part of the masculine for something that is not yet masculine and will cease to be desirable when it becomes so.
Yes, it reminds me of the work that scholars have done thinking about boyhood almost as a third gender in the early modern period. And that distinction that you make between practices of sodomy at this time and homosexuality today is crucial, because in fact we're almost looking at the inverse. What is considered acceptable then is not now, and vice versa. Do we have any evidence of the feelings of the boys in these cases?
Mostly no. And this is one of the big sort of disappointments to the historian. One would like very much to get, so to speak, both sides of the story. We have in the literature, if I'm still just talking about Muslim society, the Ottoman Empire, in the literature, we have poems, romances and so on, which sometimes describe cruel boys who are well aware that they are being worshipped for their beauty by a man who want to enslave him with their beauty. The trope which we know in the West where women were concerned, la belle dame sans merci. This is le beau garçon sans merci, the merciless boy. And of course, it's part of these accounts also that they can be quite grasping. They want to use this position for their benefit, sometimes financial, sometimes other ways of using power over the man. But how typical was that? Probably not very. It's very difficult to tell. If we move to the western half of the Mediterranean, to places like Italy, where we have in some ways much better evidence, then I think we can say there's a range of responses on the part of the boys. In many cases, the sex is casual, transactional. In some cases, the boys are obviously just coerced. In other cases, they just accept it as part of their condition of life, of being a teenager in a place such as Florence in that period. But in some cases, they are interested. They are parading themselves, perhaps hoping to find a customer. Some of that is financial, not in every case directly sort of prostitution, but hoping to be taken out for a meal, given some little gifts. And in some cases, just if the man was influential and the boy was from a poor family, it was the whole family that could benefit from patronage from this powerful man. And there are even cases in the records, I think reliable evidence, of parents essentially pimping their teenage sons to influential men. So there's a whole range of cases there. We also have a minority of cases, a small minority of cases, where the man was obviously, I'm talking now about Italian evidence, the man was infatuated in love. That turns up much more often on the Ottoman side than it does on the West Mediterranean side. But in those cases, we never get any sense that the boy was in love with the man. It's very much a one-way thing. So even there, an element of shadow descends over the evidence on the boy's side of the story.
And perhaps we can explore some of the reasons why that might have been the case, in so far as if a boy had been, say, the passive partner in a relationship earlier in his life, when he becomes an older man, there were reasons, were there not, for wishing to remain silent about that phase, I suppose, of his life.
Yes, it was in the culture. The one aspect of this basic situation that it's age differentiated, that it's adult, typically young adult man having sex with a teenage boy. One aspect of that is it's shameful for an adult man to be the passive partner. That is taboo. It's also shameful and thought to be bizarre for an adult man to want to penetrate another adult man. So it's quite specific. I've looked at articles and books by people who use this term third gender about the teenage boys in this period. In the end, I decided not to go down that path myself. They knew perfectly well that a boy was a boy, was going to turn into a man. It was a prospective first gender, or by their hierarchy, definitely first gender. But of the two, it was prospectively one of them. And that influences things because there's a slight sense of a code of masculinity, of prospective masculinity among the boys. It's not something they would normally brag about if they were being sodomized regularly by an adult man. And indeed, as you say, when they become an adult, and they may then start taking the active role with people younger than themselves, they do not want to be reminded that they used to be on the other side of the story. There's a rather funny anecdote in the work of Evliya Çelebi, going back to the Ottoman side, fantastic writer of the 17th century, who wrote this enormous travelogue. He traveled all around the Muslim world. It's extraordinary how far he went, and even partly into Western Europe. And he describes a fountain on a hillside in Bulgaria, which is called the Fountain of Luck. Now, it was one of those intermittent fountains that they gurgle and suddenly produce a lot of water, and then they stop for 10 minutes. And he said the tradition there was that if you went up to the fountain, it would stop if you were a man who had been sodomized when you were a teenager. And it was a sort of challenge. You had to go up to the fountain, but in view of other people. He describes all the men hanging back nervously because they were terrified that the fountain would stop because so many of them had been. And then he rather proudly says that he went up and he was okay. But he admits that he'd been nervous too. So yes, there was a perspective of masculinity even for the boy. And in retrospect, that really kicked in.
Now, listeners may have inferred this already, but one of the things that's so striking about your work is that you have noticed that there are these parallels between behaviour in the Ottoman Empire and those around the Western Mediterranean in terms of similarities, not only actually in behaviour, but in attitudes as well. Could you say a little bit more about that and talk about the nature of the evidence that leads you to that conclusion?
Yes, certainly. In some ways, as I said, the evidence is stronger and richer in parts of the Western Mediterranean world. The extreme case with an extraordinary wealth of documentation is Florence. Florence was widely believed to be a hotbed of sodomy, and there must have been some reason why the authorities in the 15th century decided that it was such a problem in their city that they should set up a special court, a special magistrature, devoted simply to dealing with cases of sodomy. And they allowed anonymous denunciations. They allowed walk-in people to come confess. If they did that, they got a much lighter penalty. But the main method they used was by making the penalties generally light enough so it wasn't a sort of life-threatening thing, as it was in other jurisdictions at the time. You might pay a fine, but you could clear your name by just getting through all of this and regulate your position vis-a-vis the authorities. But then the records of this magistrature, luckily, survive intact. A brilliant American historian called Michael Roque, I'm pretty sure that's how he pronounces it. It's spelled Rock with an E on the end, but it's pronounced Roque. He went through these and wrote a superb book processing all the evidence. And what he showed is that during that period of about 40 years, 13,000 Florentine men and boys had their names in one way or other presented to this tribunal. Now, that doesn't mean they were all prosecuted. A lot were just sort of mentioned in other people's allegations or confessions. Some of them may have been bogus accusations and so on. But still, 13,000 men and boys, it is quite astonishing. And in the end, they prosecuted a significant percentage of those, and they ended up with 2,000 convictions. So because we have sometimes quite detailed accounts of the evidence at individual trials, Michael Roque was able to build up a great database which covers all sorts of aspects of the behavior. And so we're able to do demographics, we do the age ranges, we can say what percentage of the passive partners were under the age of 19, the answer is over 90%. What percentage of the active ones were 19 or over, and it's a bit under 90%. We can look at the exceptional cases, they're actually quite interesting. There are some passive adult males, the most taboo category. There are some who are engaged in reciprocal sex, both active and passive, with the same partner. And these are tiny minorities, but if you put them together, you get a fringe of 10, 12% of the total who are not conforming to the general pattern. But the general pattern is there. It's massive. It's dominant. And it conforms exactly to what you find in all the Ottoman evidence, even though that is mostly not based on things like trial reports. It's other kinds of evidence, literary, documentary, and in other ways. So yes, I think one of the basic things that struck me when I really got into this subject was there is a single Mediterranean pattern where the sexual behavior is concerned. It's based on age differentiation. And the threshold in Italy or Spain is just the same. It's when the boy starts growing facial hair. And they have special vocabulary for this, a beardless boy against a bearded boy. And you have technical words like that in Arabic and Turkish. So the whole system of behavior is the same, as in so many other ways, really. When you look at the Mediterranean, you find it doesn't divide neatly along national or religious lines. There is a Mediterranean culture. It's a major example of that. But at the same time, there are some differences. As I said, the visibility of sodomy and of the sort of pursuit of boys, including a rather sort of romantic, literary, poetic pursuit of boys, in the Ottoman world is much greater. It was not respectable generally in Western Europe to express in any literary format desire for a beautiful boy. There's a very small exceptional literature which does. Some of it was clandestine, some of it circulated in the manuscript and was often snapped up by the authorities and burnt. It does exist, but it's a minor phenomenon, whereas in the Ottoman, the Muslim world generally in this period, it's major. Most of the love poetry there is expressing love for boys. It's not love poetry for girls or women. So there are cultural differences, but the sexual behaviour is remarkably similar.
Much of the evidence that historians can draw on for the Western Mediterranean is from criminal courts, from the Inquisition and similar other jurisdictions. What do we know about how legal responsibility is apportioned? Is it on both partners? And what is the severity of punishment and how does this vary in different areas?
Different jurisdictions handle these things in, to some extent, different ways. And there are quite a lot of different jurisdictions. I've mentioned the special tribunal in Florence. There was a similar one in Lucca. These were unusual because, as I said, they had very lenient policies on punishment, and it was a different matter from what happened at the same time in, say, Venice or Rome or Barcelona or Seville, where lots of people were sent to be executed for sodomy. And you could have city tribunals, you could have the ordinary criminal courts, you could have ecclesiastical courts, or in some places you could have the Inquisition. People may imagine, oh, that's the Inquisition would have dealt with this, but actually it didn't in Italy. And in Spain, it didn't in most of the territory of Spain. It operated only in three territories that were the mainland parts of the Kingdom of Aragon on the sort of eastern and southeastern side, so Barcelona, Valencia, and Saragossa. But otherwise, it was just ordinary criminal courts in Spain, and then it was the Inquisition in Portugal. So they've all got slightly different methods. Generally, they do distinguish between the partners, the active and the passive. And at the same time, that's a distinction between adult and boy. And there are obvious reasons for that in terms of common sense arguments about responsibility for the act. In some cases, the boy has been the object of coercion. He's just been innocently going for a walk on a summer evening in the city, and some man has grabbed him, dragged him into an alleyway, and more or less raped him. And those cases are fairly clear. Of course, there are many others that are not so clear, including ones where the boys were engaged in something more like prostitution. But in many of these jurisdictions, there are differing ages of criminal responsibility. In parts of Spain, the age was actually as high as 24. So that can make a difference, full adult legal responsibility. So yes, on the whole, it's the man who gets the heavier punishment. But typically the boys are also punished in most of these jurisdictions, but on a lower tariff, so to speak. And whereas the adults can be sent off to be executed by hanging and burning, the rotting and then burning in Spain, generally speaking, boys are not executed, although in some cases they are, if they're thought to be exemplary cases, where this will have an effect on the sort of moral psychology of the whole community. Again, in a way, it confirms that this is a more general phenomenon understood by the general population. It's not an astonishing to them monstrous, inexplicable thing if a case comes before them involving a man and a teenage boy. They know how it works, they know how it goes on, and they know that there are differing degrees of responsibility.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
American politics are all struggle and strategy, passion and persuasion, and so much scandal. And they always have been. I'm Don Wildman, and on American History Hit, we're delving into Alexander Hamilton, whose bio was big enough for Broadway. From war to women and a dueling death to boot, Hamilton is a fundamental chapter of the American tale. Join me and a cast of worldly experts to meet the real Alexander Hamilton on American History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
In the circumstances, one would expect protestations of other sexual activity beside perfect sodomy, as it's described, completed sodomy that has involved penetration. But what was fascinating to me about your work is it shows that actually there are some instances of other types of sexual behaviour, but they're not nearly as common as I would have anticipated, especially given the sort of judicial circumstances in which these relationships are occurring.
Yes, it's difficult to know how to pitch one's expectations, really. To what extent should other forms of allegedly deviant sexual behavior, to what extent should they have appeared in the records? On the one hand, we have the theologians who, from the Middle Ages onwards, are rolling their sleeves up and doing the job of classification. And the big classification comes under the heading sins against nature, contra naturam. Now, what is nature? This is something that set many learned minds going, and it was very difficult to reach a fully agreed conclusion about that. Man's nature was corrupted by the fall of Adam and Eve. Some things don't go with nature that are regarded as virtuous, such as Catholic priests never getting married or having children. How natural is that? So they never had an absolutely solid basis on which to build these arguments, but the broad classification that emerged was that sexual sins against nature were sodomy, male-female sodomy, a man penetrating a woman anally, bestiality, man penetrating a female farmyard animal, and masturbation, which could be solitary or mutual. And there are one or two other categories that come and go, but these are the essential ones. No, they all got categorized by the church as serious sins, and in varying degrees, they were incorporated into legislation. Masturbation generally was not criminalized, but one jurisdiction did put it in the criminal law, that was Portugal. So far as we can tell, there was never a single prosecution of someone simply for masturbating. I think the modern expression wasting police time might come to mind, and they didn't have proper police in those days anyway, so you can imagine it was rather idealistic, if one can put it like that, for the Portuguese king to put this in the law code. But the other things could be and were prosecuted. Men sodomizing women, this comes up occasionally. Sometimes it's the man's wife who has got so fed up with this that she's complained and instigated a court action. But the general rules required two witnesses for a conviction. Difficult to think how you could get that for something that's happened in the marital bedroom. And there's also the question of shame. It would be very shameful for a woman to go before the public in a court and discuss these things. So there are not so many examples of that coming before the court. Bestiality is an interesting one. It was prosecuted. It was regarded as monstrous. And in Northern Europe, which perhaps we'll come on to after a while, you get quite a lot of cases relative to sodomy. But in the Mediterranean countries, sodomy greatly outnumbers bestiality in the courts. And this, I think, is interesting because in this period, most populations outside the cities, a few small city-states, but most national populations are massively agricultural. And you would think access to sheep and cows and so on is pretty widespread. And in some ways, it's less trouble having sex with one of those. They're not going to take me to court for it. Boys' parents, when angered, particularly the boy had been physically harmed, did take the men to court. No one's going to take them to court on account of a sow or a ewe. And yet there are quite a lot of prosecutions, but not as many as there are of sodomy. And I think sodomy was just culturally ingrained in a way that bestiality wasn't.
Now, with what you've said about the church's attitudes towards sodomy in its multiple forms and about representations in art and culture, we're starting to get an answer towards the question I'm about to pose. And I don't indeed know if there is more of an answer. What can we know of the attitudes of ordinary people towards male-male sexual behaviour?
If we're still talking about the Mediterranean region, I think we can deduce A, that there is broad understanding of what is going on there. As I said, it's not a sort of monstrous, outlandish thing that they've never had reason to think about until a case suddenly emerges. They know the score, more or less. And in some parts of Italy, particularly Tuscany, maybe Sicily as well, over the years that they were teenage boys, if you're looking at the male side of the population, a lot of them would have experienced this in a more than theoretical way. So there is familiarity. Then B, there's the question of the official norms, the norms of religion and the norms of law. And these are very strenuously anti-sodomy. It's a mortal sin, and it's, in many jurisdictions, in principle, a capital offence. And if you don't actually get executed, you might, in the later Middle Ages, this punishment fades away after a while. You might be castrated, or you might have your nose chopped off. There are really horrible physical punishments here, or there could be massive fines, or there could be banishment for 10 years. So when you have norms as strong as that, it's not surprising that they get internalized. And quite a lot of people just feel this is deeply, horribly sinful. And there's another factor at work there, which is that in the Middle Ages, somehow the sin of sodomy got mixed up in people's minds with the sin of heresy, probably because of the Cathar heresy, the dualists who wanted to separate themselves from the impurity of the material world, which was not properly God's creation, but was the thing you had to get away from in order to become more godlike. And the elite apparently would be celibate. They would not have sex with anyone. And so a sort of popular belief got going that if you didn't have sex with women, you were exhibiting qualities of one of these terrible heretics. Now, what's the point of bringing up this apparent connection with heresy, which to modern eyes is very strange? Because that was the tipping point in Western mentalities towards thinking of sodomy not as a private thing that you just had to go and tell your confessor about, and would give you heavy penances and then you could be absolved, but thinking of it as a communal thing that affected the community you lived in. And that had a big effect on the legislators, the secular lawmakers who put this in their criminal codes with these heavy penalties. So when you have all of that, there are norms that do get internalized, and a lot of people think it is absolutely disgraceful. They're not entirely surprised by it, but they think it's worth stamping it out. But on the other hand, there are people who perhaps have some close experience of it, or in view of this underlying assumption that the desire itself is natural, even if acting on this is terribly wrong, they think this is the way of the world, people are like that. And unlike fornication, it doesn't produce the problem of illegitimate children. Unlike adultery, it doesn't produce what to their eyes was much worse, the problem of the threat to the bloodline of the husband. His wife is committing adultery elsewhere. Who knows who is the real father of his children? In some ways, you can see why elements in the general population might have thought it's not doing anyone else any harm. And if they don't physically harm the boy, and happened to me when I was young, it never did me any harm. That sort of attitude, you can see that would have some traction. So I think the full answer has to be there was a spectrum. Some people are very disapproving. There are enough of those in these societies to constitute the angry witnesses who say, I was just in this tavern and I happened to wander into a back room and this terrible thing was happening and I immediately went and reported it to the constables. So there are those people at one end of the spectrum. But at the other, there are those who think it's sometimes a bit of a joke. In the Italian literature of the period, as I said, you get very little in the way of direct expressions of sexual desire for boys, but you get comic stories from Boccaccio and people like that, making light of it in a way. It may be satirical, there may be a moralistic edge somewhere, but it's part of the stock humor of funny things going on in the population. So I think you have a complete range of attitudes, but the fact that it remains a sort of major phenomenon socially suggests that the very disapproving people were never a strong majority.
The other important thing that you have done in your work is not only to make parallels between Western Mediterranean and the Ottoman world, but also to highlight the fact that very few historians have compared that society and those kind of shared cultural norms with Northern Europe. Why not? Is it a question of evidence? And what ultimately should we make of the paucity of prosecutions in Northern Europe?
Indeed. This, in a way, is the central investigation of my book, because I think people have badly missed this point, and this is a really major point. You ask why they've missed it. Was there a problem with the evidence? Combination of two things. Yes, there was a problem with the evidence. There just wasn't much evidence. And at the same time, when historians started looking seriously at the history of sodomy, history of what we now call homosexuality, or the prehistory of what we now call it, it coincided with a period of gay activism and consciousness raising. Some of the historians who were real pioneers, did really valuable work, were not just gay historians, they were themselves gay activists. An American called John Boswell, who wrote a classic book on medieval, he called them gay people before this modern sensitivity to vocabulary had fully kicked in. And in England, a man called Alan Bray, who was a real pioneer, an admirable man. He wasn't in an academic job. He was actually a civil servant, but he had scholarly interests and instincts. And he wrote a book called Homosexuality in Renaissance England, 1982. So really pioneering work. And he had spent his weekends and his evenings, what was then the British Museum Library, no, the British Library and the Public Record Office, as it was, going through trial records. And he puzzled over the fact he found so few cases. And I think his sort of background assumptions had led him to believe that it must have been a major thing. And this general assumption that modern homosexuality is anachronistic, although he put the word in the title of his book, he was sensitive to the idea that it might have been a very different phenomenon in this period in the past, and that the modern full sense of homosexual identity was not something that you had then. So he thought if people didn't have the idea of homosexuals as a type, perhaps they didn't notice them so much, and perhaps they didn't write about them so much. But anyway, he started with an assumption that there must have been a lot of sodomitical behavior going on. And the real question was, why does it not show up in the evidence? And so his answer was, the reason why we don't get many trial records is that essentially it was so widespread and so generally accepted in some way or other that it didn't occur to people to report it to the authorities or to take people to court. No, I'm simplifying slightly. He begins by saying it's cognitive dissonance. They've been fired up by preachers that it's this monstrous, devilish sin. And then when they notice that two of their neighbours are in a sort of same-sex relationship, they can't connect that with this monstrous, devilish thing because it just seems so ordinary and everyday in comparison. And he says it's not a question of them being tolerant. But then as he develops this argument, it sounds as if it is a question of them being tolerant in the sense that they have an understanding of what's going on and they don't feel any impulse to denounce it or to prosecute it. And so his argument is that the lack of evidence actually confirms this idea that it was widespread and because it was so everyday. And this shows just how everyday it was, because on almost no days did anyone feel so shocked that they would report it. If you just stand back and think about this as a way of conducting a historical argument, I'm sorry to criticize because I think Alan Bray was a very admirable pioneering figure, but honestly, you tell your students absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Fine, they get that very quickly. But this is saying absence of evidence is virtually proof of omnipresence, which is just a very strange argument. We don't have evidence of homosexuality in the spirit, therefore it must have been everywhere. I'm simplifying slightly, but this satisfied a lot of people because I think particularly the sort of generation of gay writers at that time, they were engaged in consciousness raising. They felt they represented a community that had been in the shadows and had been reviled and excluded. Part of their job as historians now was to bring everything out into the light. And they just assumed there was much, much more there to be brought out into the light. And if it wasn't there, you know, it was partly for the reason Bray gave, but in any case, it was their job, so to speak, to maximize the findings for purposes of redressing the balance. Sorry, I'm giving a rather long answer, but it's interesting to see how this happened. So that's the first part of the answer. The second part of the answer is that Bray's book came out in 1982. Just a few years later, serious archival scholars in Spain and Italy started producing evidence in Spain and Italy of the widespread phenomenon of sodomy in those societies. And so very quickly, people dealing with London or Paris or Amsterdam, Hamburg, they thought, we've got this wonderful evidence now. It's early modern Europe. Look, we've got this fantastic evidence from Florence. We've got it from Barcelona. We've got it from Venice. We can see that it was widespread. It was age differentiated. We know what early modern sodomy was. So we don't need to go hunting away in the trial records in the public record office in London because we've got the whole pattern already. And so they just lowered this pattern like a template onto Northern Europe, assuming that there was a pan-European pattern of sexual behavior. And what I've realized is, no, there wasn't. The reason why there's much less evidence from Northern Europe is that it wasn't widespread there in the way that it was in the South. It wasn't a generally understood phenomenon in the way that it was in the South. And it wasn't the Mediterranean age-differentiated pattern. And there was no life cycle of teenage boys having to submit to this and then after the age of 20 becoming the active person going out and inflicting it, if that's the right word, on the teenagers below them. The Mediterranean life cycle did not obtain in Northern Europe. The whole system of sexual behaviour was different.
Just two more questions before we finish, because there's so much your book goes into with regard to this. But let me try and get at an important point as we move forwards in time. Because whilst your work reveals that we absolutely have this different culture happening in 16th and 17th century Northern Europe, it does become clear that from 1700 onwards, we see something different, perhaps one could put it like that. It appears that the interest in cracking down on sexual behaviour, the sort of vigilante policing that becomes active after that period, reveals, or perhaps to some extent, I don't know, creates the evidence that we have of male-male relationships. What do you think is happening around 1700? I mean, to be facile about it, we don't suddenly have a great awakening among the male population to their sexual identity, do we?
No, the 1700 watershed has become a sort of fixed orthodoxy among those who write about these matters. Go back to the point I made right at the beginning about the use of the word homosexuality, a late 19th century thing, and people saying we'd better not be anachronistic because maybe it's arguable that homosexuality as such only began then And before that, you didn't have people that could be identified as homosexuals. That sort of way of looking at the past, which was derived above all from Michel Foucault, the great French sort of theorist and to some extent historian, that got pushed back from the late 19th century to the 1700s. And that is, watershed. And that is essentially because there was such rich evidence emerging in London and Paris and the Netherlands in the first three and a bit decades of the 18th century, which showed men having sex with men. It showed clear aspects of a kind of identity, people talking about themselves as a different kind of person, saying they never had any sexual interest in women. It seems to open up a whole new world, which is much, much more like the modern world where we use the word homosexuality. And so the basic structure of the argument remained the same about this sort of pre-modern versus modern, but the dividing line was pushed back to 1700. And to fit the modern pattern, historians dived in looking for certain things that would be particularly significant in their eyes, such as effeminacy, scant behavior. And they found some small elements of it. And they, I think, blew this up into a much larger thing than it really was at the time. It's, look, we have all the elements of modern homosexual identity. They think of themselves as almost a different gender, somewhere between male and female, that they've got a strong sense of identity, they're socializing together. I think if you look at what the nature of this evidence is, it's clear the big change around 1700 is a change in the methods that generate the documents. As you say, vigilante policing in London, huge wave of vigilantism, mainly directed against female prostitutes, against gambling and other moral sins. It's a sort of leftover of 17th century Puritanism, now among respectable folk in London in the beginning of the 18th century. But it takes in the sodomites as well, and they send out agents provocateurs in order to entrap them. And the same thing happens for slightly different reasons in Paris. And then in the Netherlands, it's different again, more different because there's no sudden change in policing, but there's a moral panic that grips the whole nation after a particularly elaborate case sends out lists of people reported as having engaged in this with one extremely promiscuous young man. And then magistrates all over the Netherlands start hunting down these people, and then it gets into the newspapers and so on. So in these slightly different ways, we have a lot of evidence generated. And it's an easy mistake to make to say suddenly we've got all this evidence we had very little before, therefore something radically has changed. The only thing that's radically changed is the method of generating all this evidence. We've just had lots of police archives that we didn't have before. But if you look at the nature of the behavior, for almost everything that you see in those detailed police reports from the early 18th century, you can find analogues or pretty much the same things in the previous two centuries in Northern Europe. And people thought, oh, this is all different and modern, because they were stuck with that assumption that before 1700, you could just use the evidence from Florence and Barcelona to fill in the gaps in Northern Europe. No, of course, it does look very different from that. It is much more like modern homosexuality, and it's not like that Mediterranean pattern, which is so different from what we call homosexuality. But in Northern Europe, they didn't have the Mediterranean pattern. And what they had was just a lot of what now emerges suddenly in the early 18th century. Now, of course, I'm not saying nothing changes. There are developments. The socializing becomes much more common with huge expansion of, above all, of London in the late 17th, early 18th century, and a greater sense of moral freedom. Puritanism as a public moral regime is dead. These people want to revive it, but in the end, they're sold out and booed off the stage by a more general public. Yes, the history books in the last generation or so have become obsessed with the 1700 watershed. What I'm arguing is that if you look properly at Northern Europe before 1700, you'll see there's total continuity. There's no sudden change. And what they missed was the fact that it really wasn't the Mediterranean pattern in Northern Europe to begin with.
So to end then, let's return to where we started and ask what conclusions you think we should then draw about behaviour and identity and how we talk about these things as historians.
It's difficult. Identity is a very multifaceted thing. It's become a very popular thing to theorise. And I think it's very difficult for a historian to know exactly what they're meant to be proving if they go off into the past in search of whether a certain kind of identity existed or not. To put it crudely, I think the last 40 years of history writing on the subject have got it wrong because they started with this a priori grand divide between the pre-modern and the modern. And so they were looking for the emergence or the birth or the transformation that would suddenly give you the modern. And so the modern to them came as a whole package. And modern homosexuality does involve quite a strong sense of identity. To some extent, that's a socially projected one. It involves being part of some sort of community of like-minded people, but it's also a sense of just important aspects of the person's being, a sense they're not like their sort of heterosexual friends and colleagues, and all of that, fine. But I think it's a big mistake for a historian to take as a package a complex, distinctly modern thing like that, and then just go off into past centuries and say, this is what we're looking for. And we'll know it when we see it, or we'll know it when we think we see it, because we're so programmed now to take any sort of bits of that, if we find them, as implying that the whole package is there. And what I've suggested is, no, identity is in some ways more limited. The further back you go, some kinds of identity exist. It's also more multifarious. There are different kinds of identity. Another aspect of the modern idea of homosexuality is that it tends to put it all under a single label. And so there's one big thing, which indeed is also homosexuality in male and female, and that's all part of one thing, one phenomenon called homosexuality. This is not the case in the past. A bit late for me now, but I add my apology for the fact that my book is only about the male story. It's not about the female. But as I did the work, it became more and more clear to me that the female story is very interesting, but it is a very different story. It's not really part of it. It doesn't link up with the story I'm telling. But so all of these modern assumptions, I think we should abandon them. We should go into the past, take identity on its own terms as we find it there. And yes, there are Renaissance medical writers who discuss the strange case of the passive adult male who wants to be sodomized, and they describe him sometimes as a distinct physical type and a distinct psychological type. There are people who write about effeminate men as a clearly recognizable type. There are people who write about men who fell in love with boys and were besotted with them to the point of being ridiculed by their friends and colleagues. All of these things have aspects of identity. It's not just a matter of acts versus identity. The modern way of looking at it says, if you don't have the full modern identity, then whatever you were doing was just a matter of certain acts in bed and there's nothing more we can say about it. No, these people had aspects of their selfhood involved, but we need to look at those as they come to us in the evidence and not try to imagine that we've got bits of a jigsaw and we can just put in all the missing parts, because we know the eventual picture, even in 1600 or 1500, should be this or that. So it's a rather ragged, inconclusive answer to your question, but I think it's the job of historians just to try to follow the evidence. And if the evidence doesn't satisfy modern criteria, that suggests there's something wrong, from a historian's point of view, with the criteria.
Well, Michel Foucault may have been only something of a historian, but today we have had a masterclass in how to do the sort of careful, nuanced, and insightful historical study on sexuality that one should hope for. So, Noel, thank you so much for your time. I direct people again to reading your book, which we have scratched the surface of the enormous research in it, but it is a really incredible piece of work, Forbidden Desire in Early Modern Europe, which is out now. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much indeed.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, and also to my researcher, Alice Smith, my producer, Rob Weinberg, and Ella Blacksall, who edited this episode. We're always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, @notjusttudors. And do remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released. History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.